you are.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the 30th anniversary of President Nixon's history-changing visit to the Chinese mainland, President Bush arrives in Beijing tonight. China is Bush's last stop on a tour of the Pacific. His visit is the latest turn in a fluctuating relationship. Things got off to a rough start in April of last year, not long after the president took office. An American spy plane crashed on Chinese soil, and President Bush warned that Sino-American relations were about to plunge into a deep freeze.
This is an unusual situation in which an American military aircraft had to make an emergency landing on Chinese soil. Our approach has been to keep this accident from becoming an international incident. This accident has the potential of undermining our hopes for a fruitful and productive relationship between our two countries.
Following September 11th, the pendulum swung towards warmer relations. The Chinese government supported U.S. military action in Afghanistan, and America found a new ally in the war on terror. Earlier this week, in an address to the Japanese parliament, President Bush applauded this new spirit of cooperation.
We're grateful for China's cooperation in the war against terror. We both supported China's entry into the World Trade Organization. And we will work with China in the great task of building a prosperous and stable Asia for our children and for our grandchildren.
While in China, President Bush will be following the 30-year-old footsteps of Richard Nixon. Like Nixon, Bush believes in constructive engagement with China. But Bush has only 30 hours to meet with the Chinese leadership. In the year of the horse, will U.S.-China relations gallop forward or shy away and retreat? What are your hopes and fears regarding China and U.S.-China relations in what President Bush has called the Pacific Century? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio is Robert Ross, professor of political science from Boston College and an expert in U.S.-China relations. Welcome, Robert Ross.
Thank you.
Also here in the studio is tonight's news analyst, Jyoti Puri. She's a professor of sociology and women's studies at Simmons College in Boston. Welcome to you.
Hello, Jack.
Let's start with you, Mr. Ross. Can you, the major issues in this relationship, let's just briefly review them. And sort of on the Chinese side, these include missile defense, the U.S. weapons sales to Taiwan, and the whole notion of U.S. hegemony. And on our side, on the American side, we have weapons proliferation and human rights. Take the Chinese side first. How does America, how does the Bush administration look to Chinese eyes?
I think it's fair to say when the administration came in, they were intent on establishing a new tone to our China policy. They watched the Clinton administration and they saw inconsistency. The message was, we're here, we know how to use power, and we will be firm. And their rhetoric from day one said, don't challenge us. Beneath that, there was also a substance of this policy that was different. One was toward Taiwan, of course, the most sensitive issue to the Chinese and in U.S.-China relations. And there we were moving away from arms sales and toward a defense relationship with Taiwan that was moving closer and closer to what we might call eventually a de facto alliance. That was alarming. Second, we identified common interests with Chinese neighbors and sought to bolster defense ties. And the new initiative there was with India. And we just recently reached an agreement with India whereby we can now once again sell weapons to India. And again, the foundation for that is common interest toward China. And then, as you mentioned, missile defense. The Chinese are very concerned that as we develop a missile defense system, we will basically eliminate their deterrent capability, and will leave them open to blackmail to the United States.
And what about the general feeling about hegemony? I mean, this is a resonant phrase in Chinese statements about America. And of course, now we're basing forces in South Asia, near the Chinese border. How is that dialogue going down within the party, the whole fear of American hegemony?
I think there are two elements there. One is something the Chinese share with much of the world. Since the end of the Cold War, the American has shown little restraint in using force around the world, intervention in other countries' domestic affairs. Mm-hmm. And so the Chinese share that concern in watching America expand. But second, the United States has identified China mm-hmm. as the greatest threat to global stability, to the rising power of the 21st century, to the greatest challenge to American interests. And so as they watch America grow and expand its presence, particularly in Asia, they see themselves as the target of American power. And given American strength, that's not very comforting.
Now, on the American side, we look at them, and our complaints are weapons proliferation, possibly even to countries in the axis of evil. Tell us the score on that. How do things stand what's our bill of complaints against the Chinese?
That's a fairly complex situation. The first example of proliferation took place in 1988, many years ago. And since then, we've been negotiating and have yet to reach a conclusion. Having said that, the Chinese understand the sensitivity of that issue and have been careful to control the arms sales.
Arms sales to?
Well, for example, Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
In some respects, that's the least volatile partner with China
mm-hmm.
because we understand there's a vital security relationship there, and we see that as an exception to a rule of overall compliance with general international regimes covering proliferation.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's general proliferation that is not covered by regimes in which China may sell this item or that item mm-hmm. to countries in the Middle East that we consider destabilizing.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like them to cooperate there as well. The Chinese perspective is what you call proliferation,
mm-hmm.
we call proliferation toward Taiwan. And we don't see a difference.
In other words, our arms sales to Taiwan are the same as their arms sales to Iran.
An arms sale is an arms sale.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't like theirs, not so much because it's a weapon,
mm-hmm.
but because who we're selling it to.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't like ours because we're selling it to Taiwan.
And this proliferation from them isn't necessarily weapons of mass destruction.
Absolutely
not. This is just arms sales.
That's absolutely true. And most of them fall below the threshold covered by international agreements.
And, of course, we are the world's leading arms trader.
That's absolutely correct. The Chinese will go a step further and say, you believe that missile sales are destabilizing mm-hmm. because missiles are delivery vehicles for weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese say they fail to see a difference between an F-16 and a missile. And perhaps most countries would rather use an F-16 that we sell to deliver a lethal weapon.
Mm. Finally, human rights. What are our complaints there? And in fact, is there a particular? I read there's someone now, an American citizen, perhaps in prison in China, whom the president wants to get pressure to get. Tell us that story.
You know, I think there's no question we have some major human rights violations going on in China.
Mm-hmm.
And China's a country the American people deeply watch and care about. And so the Chinese transgressions take on a particular resonance in the American population and become particularly important in our foreign policy. Having said that, we've learned over the last decade that our ability to influence China's human rights policies are very limited. Even Bill Clinton, who I think was committed to using trade as leverage for human rights, basically failed. And I think we understand now that we're dealing with a great power, and to hold hostage a relationship with the great power to human rights is a risky business. So human rights has come down in our agenda. We care deeply, but I think we understand the limitations. So the president, when he goes to China, will make a pitch. Please, release some of these people you're holding and allow me to speak on behalf of human rights. Certainly we know he will be given the bully pulpit. He will be able to speak American values. Who will be released if, when, that remains uncertain.
Of course, American conservatives, and not them, not the conservatives alone, have said ever since the Clinton normalization of trade with China, look, we are selling out Christians in China who are being persecuted for their faith, and we're selling them out to the interests of American corporations who want to do business there. And they're saying, what comes first? Our own values, especially our own sense of religious freedom, or the interests of our corporation?
This is a difficult issue, and absolutely true that we have discovered the limits on using trade for human rights, including religious freedom. I think one problem there is that we need to keep our eye on big business and understand what it does. It also employs many Americans. So a major benefactor from the Chinese market is the Boeing Corporation. Mm-hmm. And it's the major employer of Seattle. And we know that when Boeing goes into recession, so does Seattle. Mm. So there are many interests at stake in our relationship with China. And if we could use our economic leverage to coerce political change, we might. But we should also understand that if we were to curtail trade with China, the Germans and the French and the Japanese would quickly step in.
Would step right in.
And yeah. So our leverage would be nominal, but our loss would be great.
Yeah. Joining us now from Beijing is Zheng Sui Qin. He's a writer for the Christian Science Monitor, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and the Far Eastern Economic Review. He's based in Beijing. Welcome.
Hello.
Your article in The Nation paints China as really having the worst of two worlds. You were traveling in rural areas in China, and you paint a situation of the worst of communism, dictatorship,
right. Yes.
Suppression of workers' rights, and the worst of capitalism, inequality,
yes.
A kind of moral squalor. China sounds as if it's caught right between them.
Well, the situation in China right now is that you have free market capitalism without institutions to check the basic instincts of people. You don't have rule of law. You don't have freedom of press. You don't have grassroots organizations to counter the interests of vested corrupt groups. And that's really the fundamental problem right now in China.
The vested corrupt groups being party members who are living the good life and who are cutting deals with foreign companies. Is that the sort of thing?
That's essentially it. You basically have the government officials, the military security apparatus, the police, the secret police. You also have the urban rich who got rich through their connections with the party.
And there's now a kind of chumminess between the party and the capitalists. So we last year, as we said in our introduction, the party will now admit capitalists as members.
Right. This has been going on for a decade now. And last July, Jiang Zemin took the step of recognizing this trend.
Yeah. You point out that as part of the economic rationalization of China, part of it under the pressure of the necessities of joining the WTO, something like 70 million Chinese have lost their jobs, state workers. What's become of them? What are they doing?
Well, they're very poor, they're unemployed, they're unemployable. These are people who grew up in the Cultural Revolution, who sacrificed their youth to build state factories. They were paid absolutely virtually nothing. And the government, the party, promised them that you will work for nothing, but when you retire, we will pay for your pension. As well, we will guarantee schooling for your kids so that when you come out, so when the kids come out, they'll be employable. These are people who are in their 40s or 50s. They never went to school. And then one day, the party says to them that your state factory is losing money. We're going to close it down. Mm. And sorry, we can't give you any pension. Mm. So they have a really tough time. And they do whatever they can to survive. Mm-hmm. Usually they just sell trinkets on the street. They make about maybe $50, $60 U.S. a month, and that's enough to survive. But basically, their attitude is take it one step at a time. They do whatever they can. They sell things. Some become prostitutes. Some become mafia members.
Hmm.
Those are extreme examples. Some even kill themselves. It's a very grim situation.
Indeed, it sounds like that. Jyoti Puri, what do you think about the U.S.-China relation? Are you hopeful that the president, the war on terror, gives as one European diplomat said, it was a gift to China because it changed the subject? Now they're not the enemy any longer.
Well, I'm not sure if they're not the enemy any longer, and I think this is sort of what I was hearing also Robert Ross speaking to, that it is certainly a complicated situation in terms of the U.S.-China relationship, but also that the U.S. has competing interests in this area. In some ways, yes, there is the need to expand trade, to get China to open up its markets, to really build and foster that relationship economically, at the same time to try to curtail China's political leverage, either with particular groups or with particular nation states. So I think that, I mean, I, yeah, I'm not very hopeful in the sense that I think there are competing interests here.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about China, the United States, capitalism, communism. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're really asking you for to call with your hopes and fears about China and the U.S.-China relations in the Pacific century. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests are Zheng Shui Chin, a writer for the Christian Science Monitor and the Far Eastern Economic Review. He's in Beijing, where President Bush is expected soon. And with us also here in the studio is Robert Ross, professor of political science at Boston College, and our news analyst, Jyoti Puri. Robert Ross, the premise of U.S. trade relations with China was, I think, roughly as follows. Okay, we will normalize trade. Trade will liberalize the society. The Chinese will, to use a Marxist phrase, the integument of the apparatus of state fear and repression, the integument will be burst by the new capitalist energy in the society, and thus the market, not state sanctions, not, moral addresses. The very market itself will create a more liberal society in China, maybe even break the hold of the Communist Party. On that measure of trade equaling, not trade versus, but trade equaling changes in human rights, what is the score?
I think to some extent this was oversold in our debates over normalization of trade, because the advocates had to make a very strong case. The case is that over a long period of time, as an economy develops, a middle class develops. Mm-hmm. And the middle class puts pressure on a government to open itself up. That's been the case in the Four Dragons of Taiwan, of South Korea, Hong Kong. And it's to the extent that we can correlate anything with democracy, its development. The case in China today is an interesting one, because they are at the height of the domestic instabilities we associate with modernization and eventually democracy. Hmm. Most countries fail. The most recent failure was Argentina. Mm-hmm. The one before that was Indonesia. China's watching. Their leadership is watching the inequalities, the unemployment, the crime rate, the corruption, and they're saying, can our government get through this period and eventually have the unemployment fall and have the inequality fall, and then the pressure builds for democracy? The first step is to have sufficient modernization and this government survive so that you can get over the hump and begin to modernize without instability, and then we can begin to ask the question, where is the democracy?
So in the long run, development equals, or should, if it doesn't miscarry, democracy.
It not necessarily will or should, but if you had to put your hope on something,
You'd bet on that.
This is what you'd be forced to bet on.
Zheng Shui Chin, you paint a different picture, though. You paint a picture of sort of a restive population, that the very casualties of development are now threats or potential threats to its continuance. And I have read, for example, that there have been environmental riots in China about the squalor of some of these workplaces. How about that, the picture of sort of the restive urban and rural population, possibly even a threat to the stability of the government?
Well, there are riots, protests every day. If you visit the minor cities where unemployment is a huge problem, where the economy is sagging, there are daily protests outside the local governments every day. They're protesting corruption of factories. They're protesting no more pension. They're protesting real estate schemes. They're protesting confiscation of land. Mm-hmm. This happens everywhere in China. Unfortunately, because the Chinese government has such tight control over the media, most of what goes on we're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
I would disagree with Dr. Ross's point that the government is aware of what's going on. I think that from my analysis, from what I've seen, people like Deng Zemin, the president, Zhu Rongji, come out in the state media and acknowledge this problem. They say that we should do something about it. They say they acknowledge that corruption is a major problem and that unemployment, the wealth gap, must be mollified. But if you look at what they actually do, it's very lacking.
And of course, they're limited in what they can do by, I suppose, the economic situation itself. You made a trip to Henan province, and you saw squalor, an urban wasteland, you write, replete with dirty streets, overwhelming pollution, protests outside government offices, unemployed rummaging through garbage pails for dinner. And yet, when you picked up the local paper, you saw big headlines going on about how the economy in Henan had grown by 10% that year. Does this suggest that these Chinese statistics about growth are, well, sort of Potemkin statistics? That
they're not really... These statistics are completely fabricated. When we're talking about corruption in China, we're talking about systemic corruption. Every government official has an interest in lying, fabricating statistics because the promotion depends on it. If they tell the truth, they could well lose their jobs because their higher-ups would be like, well, why aren't you fixing this problem? And if he says, well, I can't fix this problem because you're not helping me, well, then he would lose his job. So when we're talking about systemic corruption, we're talking about systemic oppression of the people, meaning that the officials from bottom to top all have an interest in keeping silent, in pretending that everything is all right.
And yet this situation, the state is functioning with all these sort of false numbers sort of sustaining a feeling of forward movement.
Right. I mean, that's basically the strategy for survival of the Communist Party right now. It's just lie. If there are critics, silence them, put them in the prison, control the state media. If there are riots, if there are protests, deal with them one by one. Don't never acknowledge that it's a national problem. The roots of the problem are too complicated, too problematic to solve. So, I mean, it's really a day-by-day solution to what's going on in China.
Listeners, what do you think about China's human rights record? Do you think that that human rights will get better or worse now that China is a member of the WTO? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from Honolulu is Drew Gladney. He's a professor of Asian studies, specifically Chinese ethnic minorities at the University of Hawaii. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Aloha.
Aloha to you. Now, you are an expert in the Uyghur people. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, you're close.
Who are these people? Why are they being persecuted by the Chinese, and how are they involved in the war on terror?
Well, I'm not sure it's quite accurate to say they're being persecuted by the Chinese. Mm-hmm. Not all Uyghurs. The government's official line is they're only cracking down on those suspected of terrorism or separatism. There's about 8.5 million Uyghurs in China. Almost all of them are in China. They're mostly located in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, which is one of five autonomous regions in China for minority nationalities, and certainly sort of Tibet and other areas. And the Uyghur are located in the far northwest region, where they have had deep history and claims to land, and there's a very strong kind of sovereignty movement that's growing in the region. And the government is very afraid that it could lead to a kind of independence movement or a separatism. And they've linked this to their war on terrorism because there have been several incidents of bus bombings, attacks on police stations that have been linked to some of these Uyghur activists.
Are the Uyghur Muslims?
Yes, they're a Muslim people. I'm sorry I didn't mention that, of course. There's about 10 Muslim nationalities in China. They're given official nationality status. Like all the other minority nationalities, about 55 separate nationalities, which includes Tibetans, Mongolians, Manchu, etc. The Uyghurs are the second largest Muslim nationality, about the fourth largest minority group in China. But they're unique in that they're all concentrated in this one region, mostly the southern Tarim Basin of northwestern Xinjiang region.
Not far from Afghanistan.
No, the region borders in the south, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and now moving north from there, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Russia, and even Mongolia. So, of course, China is very worried about these new independent countries on its border and some of the spillover effect from the Afghan war.
Is there any evidence or linking al-Qaeda to Uyghur splittists, as the Chinese call them?
Not hard evidence, especially al-Qaeda. We do have strong evidence of Uyghurs being trained by the Taliban in Afghanistan, and some Uyghurs have been caught by the Northern Alliance. There's a very strong rumor that there have been Uyghurs arrested in a group that are in Guantanamo. Certainly, young, disenfranchised Uyghur males would go to Afghanistan for training. They're about the only ones offering them scholarships at this point. And they've been found to be active with Chechenian separatists, also this Uzbekistan Islamic movement. So it's not surprising at all that some young Uyghur males would be involved with this.
Finally, is the government using the war on terror, our war on terror, as a cover for its Operation Strike Hard, which is aimed at the Uyghurs?
Not so much as a cover, but as a justification. This Strike Hard campaign has been going on since 1998, when there were a series of bombings and other social unrest. Very much like Jiang Shuaibin mentioned earlier, throughout China there have been social unrest and activism. The Uyghurs are not different from that. So the government is claiming that there's a widespread movement, an international terrorist network that the Uyghurs are part of. That remains to be seen. They haven't offered conclusive evidence of an organized movement. Isolated incidences, yes, but no group has come out and claimed responsibility. In fact, all of these Uyghur groups outside of China, and there are many, disclaim any active involvement in terrorism and have distanced themselves from the Taliban or Osama bin Laden.
Drew Gladney, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's take a call. Hugo is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hello.
I'd like to make a few comments after having just returned from a few months in China.
Please.
We're in a large city at a university, and I must say that everybody we met seemed to be not hostile at all to their government. On an American campus, you would find considerable amount of criticism of the government, and there the people seemed to believe that the government wasn't so bad. And also, I think there were many things about American democracy that they were totally unaware of. So if we make very strong statements or confrontations about human rights or religious rights, I think they would not understand it at all, and it would just backfire on us. The other thing is that their main interest seemed to be economic development, which is still going on very strongly there, and they're joining the WTO and so on, seem to be one of the biggest things on their minds, which of course they just achieved. And so it is to be hoped, and probably will happen, that as economic development goes on, they will move a little more towards democracy.
Let's check your impressions against those of Zheng Sui Chin. Do you feel sense this too among university students in China? A kind of support of the government?
I think that Hugo has hit the mark. If you're in Beijing, if you're in Shanghai, and you're talking to urban intellectuals, if you're at the universities talking to students, then Hugo is exactly right. The students are very supportive of the government. They think that the government is heading in the right direction. They think that the main priority is economic development. They think that when Americans say democracy, it's empty sloganeering, and that Americans have absolutely no interest in helping China, just making fun of China. I mean, I think that's exactly right. And my first year in China, I first came to China as a high school teacher, and I was in Beijing. I had the same impressions that Hugo had. The problem is that when I went to different cities, when I started my travels around China, I found a very different impression of China. And having been in China for about 3 years now and having met many people, I think that there are, to put this really simplistically, there are really two types of people. There are the people who know what's going on. These are the victims of corruption, the peasants and the workers. The peasants overtaxed. Their land is stolen by corrupt officials. The workers have lost their factories because of corrupt managers. These people are very pessimistic about the future of China because their lives are horrible. They don't have enough to eat. Their child can't go to school. If they're sick, they can't afford to see the doctor. Mm-hmm. That's the first. That's one group. The other group are the people at the very top. Mm-hmm. These are the people who are party insiders. They're the ones who are running the system, and they know for a fact how completely corrupt the system is. I know plenty of these people. They all have foreign passports. They know what's going on, and they have no illusions about China. They know the system is going to come crashing down sooner or later. Their child is already in the United States. Their wife is already in the United States. Most of the money is already in the United States. They're in China right now to steal as much money as possible and then get out before it comes crushing down. That's their game plan. And then you have the people who have absolutely no idea what's going on. I'll be perfectly frank. There are really two types of people who have no idea what's going on. The first are the intellectuals, the urban intellectuals, the university students who are benefiting from the system. Foreign investment means lots of good jobs for them at multinationals. So they have a stake in stability of the system. So they think everything's heading in the right direction. The second people are the foreigners who come here, spend a lot of time in Beijing, Shanghai, see a lot of buildings go up, think everything is fabulous, talk to a lot of intellectuals. Intellectuals are happy, so they're happy. These people have absolutely no idea what's going on.
Jyoti Puri.
You know, I'm really struck by the picture that Zhang is painting, and I think it's a very troubling picture indeed. And he's talking about both the political differences as well as the economic differences that are really feeding off each other in China to create this very different, distinct groups that he's describing. And that point makes me really go back to this notion of connecting development to really, in the long term, sort of a much more egalitarian, much more democratic system necessarily. And I think I disagree with Robert Ross on this and even your previous caller. I think there is a real problem here. If you think about, for example, India, mm-hmm. we have been trying to do this for a long time.
Develop.
Yeah. And I think most of the problems that Zhang is describing, to me, they seem endemic to that development endeavor, not simply a stage of development that one can overcome. And I say that because I think different nations have taken different paths mm-hmm. of development at different time periods in history. And so the situation is not all the same. So I'm not convinced at all that the outcome necessarily is a much more egalitarian, stable system pursuing this path of development, which is linked very clearly to opening up markets and to being part of the WTO. You look at the example of Korea. I mean, clearly they have come a long way. It's a really impressive case. But at the same time, the repression of labor organizations that is still going on.
Thank you. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about U.S.-China relations and the future of China at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us in Beijing is Zheng Sui Chin, writer for the Christian Science Monitor. With us here in Boston is Robert Ross, a professor of political science at Boston College, and our news analyst, Jyoti Puri. Before the break, Robert Ross, Jyoti was really questioning whether development, rather than leading to democracy, because it creates a middle class, the model you drew for us earlier, that ain't necessarily so, and that you can sort of, and that the problems, there are problems just endemic to development. It's a cure that is also a bit of a disease.
I think many of the problems that we've been looking at are not problems we associate with China.
Mm-hmm.
They're problems we associate with poverty.
Mm.
There's poverty around the world.
Mm.
India, God knows, has enough poverty for the whole world combined,
yeah.
Not to mention Pakistan and two-thirds of Africa and most of Central Asia. And so we really can't judge China as to whether there is poverty and corruption because this is still a very poor country. You judge what the country has done in the last 20 years and said, have they made an improvement?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's no doubt that they've taken 300 million people out of abject poverty and created wealth. That is a major success that no other country in the history of man has done, and the entire third world would be so lucky if they could point to that kind of success.
Mm.
Has it had problems? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Are these problems more than offset by the success? Absolutely.
Mm.
Are these problems solved? No. Are they going to get worse before they get better? Probably. But isn't an alternative to how we've seen people come out of poverty through any other way other than the kind of market reforms we've seen China undertake? Have we ever seen a country undertake the kind of market reforms and not have the problems we've seen? I would suggest never.
Mm.
This country in particular, back in the 19-teens and 1920s, lost many, many good people who did nothing wrong than to be labor activists.
Mm.
We had much repression in this country. And why? Because we were going through similar periods of inequality.
Mm-hmm.
The 19-teens and 20s, not to mention into the Depression, were very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I recall the big debate in this country a mere 15 years ago about the family farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And what would happen to our family farmer who worked so hard for the American people to put food on the table? And they were going bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
We let them go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. People in China were unemployed. We had our equivalent 20 years ago, 30 years ago. We called them the Rust Belt.
Yeah.
Major unemployment as inefficiencies made certain industries counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
That is where China's unemployment is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
In one sense, the unemployment we're seeing in China is a result of the necessary reforms, and it shows the iron will of their government to modernize.
Mm.
Whereas you point to Argentina,
mm-hmm.
that unemployment was so frightening that they undermined their economic reforms, so the system collapsed.
Mm-hmm. But China, partly because it's an authoritarian government, is willing to say, you're laid off, and that's it. We're not going to break stride for you. And we don't have to because we're not an open political system.
Yes. I mean, clearly that is one of the strengths that they have to bear, is that they can get through a transition with less instability, perhaps, than India.
Mm.
And maybe that's why India has never been able to carry out the reforms necessary, mm-hmm. because the instability would be so great. But having said that, it's often quite amazing what a powerful and strong government we have, that we are often able to make difficult decisions and then get through that period.
Mm. Zheng Swei-Chin, how does this strike you, this picture of the necessary casualties, some of these people you've been talking to, of development? Not saying that this is anything good, but that this is part of the inevitability there.
I think that if Dr. Ross made this point 10 years ago, back in 1998, I would have completely agreed with him. Back in the early 80s, when China was opening up to the world,
mm-hmm.
there was incredible wealth generation. Deng Xiaoping was eliminating a lot of the irrational economic policy of Mao Zedong, China's seclusion, the communes. He was eliminating a lot of those. A lot of people were getting out of poverty because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there were a lot of good forward-looking leaders like Zhao Ziyang, Hu Yaobang, running China at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there was also a lot of corruption. A virus that kept on growing and growing. Officials and their offspring, the princelings, abusing their power,
mm-hmm.
to steal state assets. And so the urbanites constantly protested this corruption, and the culmination of these protests led to Tiananmen Square in 1989, the June 4th movement. Mm-hmm. And then in there, the party was faced with this choice: do you fight corruption by empowering the people, by permitting to organize and fight these interest groups, by permitting them to voice their concerns in the media. And in the mid-80s, you could say that China was more free, more democratic than at any time in China's past 50 years. At that time, the Communist Party was divided, and then one person, it was repeated to have been a party elder. He said this: to not fight corruption is to doom the nation. Mm-hmm. To fight corruption is to doom the party. Mm. And we all know, and we all know what they decided.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So they decided to silence the critics, to permit corruption to grow. Mm-hmm. It wasn't intentional, but the party wants to survive at all costs,
sure.
and that meant silencing its critics,
even at the expense perhaps of the nation.
I'm a Canadian citizen. I grew up in Canada. I was born in China, but I immigrated to Toronto when I was very young. But I'm still very patriotic. That's why I'm in China, being a journalist. That's why I spent 2 years being a high school teacher. I'm very patriotic, and it upsets me. I mean, sometimes I get too emotional, but it upsets me to see so many problems and then the party denying these problems. I think that's what's wrong with the system. There are problems, but I mean, amid the problems. Now, Robert Ross said a lot.
Let me just shift you for a second. We're running short of time, and we would like to get your sense of what is the climate there in Beijing as the president is arriving. What is it like on the streets? Are people enthusiastic about this?
The point is that this has nothing to do with the people. This is Communist Party and George Bush. I mean, it's a triumph for Deng Zemin. It's a triumph for the Communist Party that George Bush is here recognizing the regime. It has nothing to do with the people. The police are monitoring the streets. There's probably an army barracks around quarantining the American embassy. George Bush is expected to go to Tsinghua University soon. You can bet. There are probably thousands of soldiers there. Before George Bush visited, the police went around, ran up all the migrant workers, ran up all the beggars, the misfits, and shipped them back to their home village or threw them in a jail. Beijing, it looks very clean right now. I mean, it would be very hard for George Bush to spot anything wrong with this country.
And is he apt to get any tough questions from these students?
These students are diehard party enthusiasts.
Uh-huh.
This is Tsinghua University. This is the breeding ground for Chinese leaders. The question they'll ask will be, why is America talking about peace yet at the same time building a missile defense? Questions like this that regurgitate the party line.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. Thank you, Zheng Shui-Chin, a writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Chronicle of Higher Education in the Far East and Economic Review. He talked to us from Beijing. Robert Ross, thank you. He's a professor of political science at Boston College. And Jyoti Puri, thank you, our news analyst for tonight. To read more about the history of U.S.-China relations, go to our website at onpointradio.org. The Guerrilla News Network is an alternative news agency based in New York City and Berkeley, California. In addition to print and video news, they frequently produce what they refer to as news videos. These are montages set to music that juxtapose disparate messages from the news media to create new, often satirical pieces. Stephen Marshall created their newest news video, S11 Redux, which creates new meanings from the media messages that came of September 11th.
You can just see it happening again.
This kind of, quote, clash of civilizations.
And this could be a defining moment.
that the world needs to march forward
to deal with the scourge of
the bearded ones
and see what they have done against
them. Because it's only going to happen with all of us together.
My name is Stephen Marshall. I'm actually the co-founder and creative director of Guerrilla News Network. Beyond the fact that we publish a daily newswire, which is sort of a, you know, an alternative left-wing slanted text-based news service, we also create these videos called news videos. And these videos are essentially a form of documentary film that is merged and sort of manipulated with the language of the music video. So it's music-driven and very design-enhanced. In the case of S11 Redux, which is our most recent video, and involves the assimilation of over, you know, sort of 20 hours of broadcast news footage over 13 networks that we've put into a sort of a 10-minute, the reformatted message around this, around the S11 tragedy and how the media and the government has spun that event.
Happy Ramadan.
It really focuses on two major themes, and that is this whole idea that Osama bin Laden has, in a sense, become this cult figure. So we actually made we made this loop that was like, you know, long live Osama bin Laden, that really juxtaposes the whole idea of Osama bin Laden being this criminal, like, person, but also at the same time this cult figure in America.
Long live Osama bin Laden.
Long live Osama bin Laden.
We have contributed to making a cult figure out of Osama bin Laden.
See, Osama bin Laden,
his stated goal,
wants to destroy America.
At least he said it to me.
That's what I say to the American people.
And then we moved into the whole issue of Islam, whether this was truly a crusade, because in many ways, though Bush and sort of the whole administration and their cronies spoke of this as being a war against terrorism, I think there's an underlying concept that in reality, it's a war against fundamentalist Islam and those people who essentially oppose our way of living in America.
Our beliefs are the very opposite of those of the fanatics.
This is a war of good versus evil.
Islam and the West
have always been at war, and we know that God is not neutral between them.
So that seems to be a major theme here.
Every nation in every region now has a decision to make.
Don't go to hell. Please, I beg you. Don't
I mean, we are definitely putting, you know, using the style and technique of editing and juxtaposition to change the message that people are saying. But what we're trying to do is show that there is a lot of spin in the media, that in fact we are constantly being, in a sense, manipulated to think in a certain way, either by corporations who want us to buy a product or by the administration who seeks to have us support what they're doing abroad and within our own country. And I think that what we're trying to do with this video is show how compelling these messages can become when they're presented by very authoritarian figures with highly charismatic presentations and on mainstream media with all the gizmos and the spectacles they have available.
But we cannot allow any other country to tell us what we can do.
It is action alone that counts.
Above all, though, you know, we're going to have to strengthen our own response.
We have air power. We have naval power.
We want to be free to do what you want to do.
Of course, that this conflict is not known.
It will never be over.
You know, the thing about a lot of culture jamming in general, and especially like these types of videos that have a lot of juxtaposition and sort of and critique of the media, are they can be very cynical and very sarcastic. And I think one of the things we tried to do differently this time was bring, or at least round out the video, conclude it with a message of hope.
Kennedy made a speech at American University in June of the year before he died. He said, "We live in one world, we got to breathe in the same air, and we got to live together, we're going to die together."
What happened?
Essentially, what I did was I went through many of the clips. Of course, were a lot of, you know, passionate reason that were being, you know, people had a lot of really beautiful things to say as well. While there was all the hype through television, there was also at the same time a lot of really conscientious and clear voices coming through. And so we actually edited and clipped a series of these people together. Most importantly, I think Barbara, you know, the author of Jihad versus McWorld, he's an amazing author and an amazing orator.
What happened? I thought we lived in a safe playground of a world where my career was the only thing I had to think about. And suddenly there's a larger, desperate, dangerous world. Explain it to me. What's it about? This isn't the world you promised me. This isn't the world you told me about. This isn't the world in which only private things count.
I think that it's so crucial to the end of our piece, because at the end of the day, we're using the media and using this format to make people think, but also we're trying to also, you know, demonstrate to everyone, and the, you know, the bulk of our audience are young people, that it really does come back to us as a species to be responsible over what's happening for all of our planet, that our leaders are really, at the end of the day, they're beholden to us, and we need to remember that.
We're going to breathe in the same air, and we got to live together, we're going to die together.
Stephen Marshall of the Guerrilla News Network lives in Berkeley, California. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
of the Crusades in every action as the West gains more power.